British forces are currently deployed on 39 operations across 46 countries. But what are they doing in these remote and far-flung locations? The FBS joined up with the MOD to find out what life's really like for those on ops. This time, we're on the COVID-19 front line in the UK.
Really good to see you guys. Have any of us ever met before? I don't think we have.
Very briefly, sir. I was obviously on the Royal Engineers Troop Commanders course, and we had one evening with you, I think, where we had a curry dinner, I believe. That's right.
Okay. All right, Jono. Well, nice to see you. That's fantastic. So if I haven't, I obviously met the mess. I always ask that now because I think, and I never ever say, I don't think we've ever met, because somebody once turned around to me and I was always worried that somebody would say something like, yes, sir, I was your best man, you know, that sort of conversation, just because you've kind of forgotten about them. So I always ask, you know, have we met? But it's really lovely to see the four of you. I think this is a great idea, sort of getting together, perhaps just to talk about our experiences, more about your experiences than mine, I guess. But I thought if I just start and then we'll do a run round. You guys probably know each other now, you've been chatting, but I don't know any of you, so. And the audience kind of listening later on, we'll love to hear what you've got to say and who you are. So I'm Tyrone Urch. I'm a serving Lieutenant General. I do a whole bunch of stuff in the Army. My day jobs, and anybody can step in and help me out in my day jobs if you want, because my life is pretty busy. But I'm Commander Home Command, which is largely about recruiting and basic training for our soldiers. And then I'm the Standing Joint Commander for the United Kingdom. So that's all about UK ops. And Rescript, you know, has been dominating all of our lives for the last 14 months. And I'm also the joint commander for a thing called Operation Bridges, which is Royal Funerals, which I thought I was going to get away with before I kind of left the job, but clearly I didn't. But I hope you agree that kind of last Saturday in the Royal Funeral was, well, in my opinion, anyway, was a masterclass. I thought our men and women on parade from all services were unbelievably amazing. And to think they pulled that off, you know, in 7 days, That it was just the epitome of what I think, you know, defence can do. So that's really, really good. And so, you know, my life has been dominated by Operation Rescript. And I can talk a little bit about how it started later on. But let's just whip around the room and let me hear a little bit about who you are, you know, where you're serving, what perhaps your little experiences were on Operation Rescript. And then we'll go into some more detail kind of later on as we kind of draw it out. But don't expect me to do all the talking. I'm rather hoping not to do, you know, much of the talking. I'm really interested, as will those listening, will really want to hear, you know, what our kind of junior officers and soldiers have been doing. And it has touched the hearts of the nation. One of the things I do say is that it's the first UK operation that has touched the entire nation, because it doesn't matter whether you're old or young, doesn't matter whether you live in a rural area or an urban area, doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, this has touched everyone, as you will know, all your friends and families everywhere. And so defence has really been in the limelight, and every single example I've seen of what our people have been doing has been genuinely amazing, and they have conducted themselves superbly. And you are four of them. So let's run around. Jono, tell me about yourself.
Sure, sir. So I'm Lieutenant Jono Anderson. Came to the Army rather late, having worked in schools. My dad used to recruit teachers, and having worked in GP surgeries for a number of years. My mum was a GP for 40 years. So a lot of nepotism going on there. So joined the Army when I was about 26, a few years ago. Obviously went through Sandhurst and Troopies course. And I posted to 3-9 Regiment, 6-5 Field Support Squadron. I've been there since. My forwarding on date is January, but my replacement's coming in August. So I've only been there since June. In the time I've been there, largely all I've done is run a few range packages and alt rescript. So deployed out to Liverpool, and we were focused on testing in schools, which I really enjoyed. You know, it was an environment I knew well anyway. And the medical side of it, I was clued up on as well. So yeah, we were pushing the efficiency quite hard because, you know, that was commander's intent. So we managed to get 300 tests done in an hour on a regular basis by the end. And we were testing a whole school in a day, you know, over 1,000 kids. So that was Liverpool. We did move into testing on some other public spaces there as well. Then I deployed to Glasgow on the next iteration of Rescript. And that was testing in the local community. I was testing in Glasgow Central Mosque, which is quite a high profile site because of the, the ethnic minority participants that we were having coming through the testing site. And since then, I've deployed to Edinburgh, to Midlothian and East Lothian councils to provide testing here for a couple of weeks. And I'm still there now in the hotel.
Okay, go on then, Ellie. Tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll sort of dip into some questions. It's a bit like a panel. You know, we've got some questions from the audience to kind of do. So you'll be surprised at what everyone else out there is interested in. It's really interesting that what they're interested in, quite personal, and they want to know how we felt about it, not just what we did. But just give us an introduction, Ellie.
Marissa, so my name's Flying Officer Eleanor Milne, or Ellie. I'm stationed up at RAF Lossiemouth in the north of Scotland. I'm a station training officer, so I have input to all aspects of training that are going on station, and I really enjoy my job. I joined the RAF relatively late, so I joined at 28, about just 2 years ago, and this is my first posting. So I've was up here for about a year before I got called for op rescript. And my rescript was based down in North Yorkshire in Kirklees, and I was operating out of RAF Leeming. And it was one of the first RAF, full RAF parts of op rescript. And I was a team leader where I was manning a test centre in Huddersfield. With a team of 25 other RAF personnel and civilians.
Great. Wow, what a story you've got. So you and Jonna, I don't know what you were doing in your previous lives, but it's the back catalogue of dirt and stories to tell before you two joined up, isn't there? So well done. And there aren't many people, Ellie, are there, that talk about going down to Yorkshire, which is really interesting. So we'll get into that, because I remember the Kirklees operation, after Liverpool and the other stuff. And actually, you two, although not at this moment in time, but, Kinloss and Lossiemouth are not far apart, I think. That's a bit of a coincidence, isn't it? Okay, we'll come back to you, Ellie. You've got a lot to tell us, which we'll all be very interested in. Okay, Durga.
So my name's Lance Corporal Durga Guru, and I'm part of QG Signals, and I am based in 1 Signal Regiment, which is not in Perham down at the moment, but we're in York. So 246 Squadron is in York, and the rest of the regiment is down in Stafford. We'll be moving down to Perham down this July as part of Op Foreign. I'm a network engineer in the Queen's Gurkha Signals, and I joined the army in 2013. Late December 2012, I first came to the UK in 2013, and I've been so far this is my third posting up in York. Previously I was in Sandhurst, helping out as part of 44 Squadron with the CIS troop, helping out the officer cadets, setting up their CPs and make sure that their comms are working. And before that, I was in Bramcote, a 30 Signal Regiment. I was there as a junior signaller and got to experience the field army for the first time there. And before op rescript, I just got off from deployments in Op Gabrit 6. So I was based in Estonia for 6 months, and which was a really good operation for me, I would say. It was my first operation, and I really enjoyed it, and I was glad to be part of Op Rescript when it was called out, to be able to help with fighting COVID with the NHS. And so in my spare time, I enjoy hobbies like climbing and mountain biking.
Wow. Okay. So we've got Jono and Ellie been involved in testing. Jono on the pilot. So that was like the first run out. That's the big Liverpool thing. But that's going to be really interesting to talk about. Ellie into Kirklees in sort of Yorkshire as it then sort of moved on and developed and became a bit more, a bit more kind of substantial and professional and organized a bit rather than our first sort of deployment. Durga, your experiences are quite a lot of difference, aren't they? You were sort of involved in what I would call, we had three pillars. One was testing, one was outbreak management, and one was vaccinations. And that's more or less how it evolved in time. We did testing first. Then we realized that the National Health Service was struggling big style. That's not a criticism, that's a fact, with its doctors and nurses and its clinical staff. But also we realized, of course, that they just needed general duties people to try and help them manage what they were doing. So is that what you were doing, Durga? You were in that middle pillar, weren't you? Which is quite a different experience.
Yes, we were part of, so I was based in Chesterfield, helping out Chesterfield Royal Hospital. I was part of the general duties. We were non-clinical, so there were other clinical staff as well, as in from the med regiments. But for me, we were part of general duties, non-clinical. So we were helping out. We were a team of four. So I was the team IC. We were a team of four, and we were each separated into different wards. There were COVID wards where we had to deal with patients one-on-one. And we did more of a helping out with the housekeeping role, where we were helping out with working alongside with the doctors and nurses and the healthcare to make sure that the patients' meals were ordered in, and also restocking supplies and also demanding whatever that needs restocking. So pretty much helping out with general duties. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, that sounds, I think that actually sounds pretty emotional. I've seen some amazing stories and vignettes of young men and women who have been, you know, really close to the front line, making great friends with sort of doctors and nurses and the sort of house staff and porters and things like that. So that's going to be really interesting to talk to you, Durga, about what is quite a different experience. So we look forward to that. And Fabian, I think your experiences as well are quite different in that third pillar, I think, in terms of sort of vaccinations and that side of it. And I don't know if you are a medic or whether you are a support officer, but tell us a little bit about you, Fabian, and your experiences.
Not too sure. So definitely a few points that will tie in with Lance Corporal Gurung's areas where he would have been working with some of my troops, possibly from Formed. But I am a medical support officer, so my job role has been troop command up at, down in Tidworth. We moved over to Tidworth Garrison from Keir Barracks towards the middle of 2019, and then set up in Tidworth with one armoured medical regiment that we work quite closely with. For myself, my next job role will be going to Operation Cobrit as SO3 Med as well, so I'm good to hear that Lance Corporal Gurung had a good time. Looking forward to getting stuck in. From the rescript side of things, there has been a lot of churn for the medical regiments, as I'm sure you're aware. Most of the time, our ROG team is bare bones back in camp because most of our medics will be deployed. At this current point, Northern Ireland, Wales, Scotland and England, all of my squadron has been deployed. I stepped in as the second in command for my squadron towards the middle of last year when things started to scale down from the first lockdown. However, there was still a huge demand for clinically facing troops. So all of our CMTs, our nurses, were very much in demand to have in clinically facing roles, but not all COVID facing ones, more with the general duties, as you mentioned, sir, looking at the maintenance and support for the NHS to be able to deliver their outputs supporting ICUs by then making sure that we are able to take over the more general duties such as injuries, road traffic incidents and the like. Our paramedics especially as well have been doing both their own placement hours as well as being involved in call outs that are consistently going with ambulance services in Wales and NHS South East. But with the new turn of the wheel coming towards the start of this year, as second in command, I initially, before being deployed myself, was maintaining the deployment of all of the CMTs towards Scotland and Northern Ireland. And then in the end, once the whole squadron was deployed, it was myself and one of my other fellow troop commanders that were sent up to JMC Scotland. And we were put in place as the military liaison officers for JMC Scotland, managing the vaccination quick reaction force. Who are delivering vaccinations across health boards all over Scotland, and then tying that in with JMC's outputs and commander back briefs to make sure that we deliver the best effect to the right areas of the country. Lots of demand initially. Again, vaccine supply is a huge dictator in the outputs in which we can achieve, but it definitely, our support was appreciated, and working so closely with the NHS over this has been a really good experience, both of my troops and myself.
Wow, Fabian, that's an amazing story. And the four of you are amazing individuals, but you have also got some terrific stories and experiences. And, you know, as the standing joint commander in Aldershot in the headquarters, you represent everything that defence, all three services have done. You have got fingers in all of those pies. So it's going to be really interesting as we just sort of chat a bit about bringing kind of what lessons and things we've learned. One of the questions that I always get asked, and I know those listening later will want to hear it, but it'll be, you know, what was it all about? How did it start? Because you've all got your experiences about how you were kind of parachuted in and probably got no notice of deploying down to Yorkshire and stuff like that, you know, and we're really interested in that. So if I just tell everyone very quickly how it all started and how defence got involved, well, you think about the first question, which is a really interesting one. And it's kind of obvious, I think, but it's about first impressions. So this will be the first time, probably, because you're all reasonably junior, although some of you have come to the military slightly late. But, you know, I think if you just think about, as your first question, all of you, sort of first impressions, and I'm thinking not necessarily first impressions with the military, but in the civilian interfaces that you had, because I've got some great stories to tell about what the NHS think about us and stuff like that. So have a think about that while I tell everyone, and maybe even you guys, maybe, you know, maybe you're not quite sure how it all started, but, and people are surprised. When I say to people, when did COVID start? Oh, it was about March the 23rd week of March, when actually the lockdown started. That's when everyone thinks that COVID started. But actually it started on the 28th of January last year. And the reason that date's important is because when we flew, we do a thing called the MACA process, which is military aid to the civil authorities. That's how we support the government. And defence is not here to run anything and do anything itself. We don't do anything by ourselves other than go on operations and fight wars. But anything we do in this country is always in support of another government department. And in this case, it's Department for Health and Social Care, of which the NHS is clearly an outreach sort of organisation. So 28th of January, we flew to Wuhan, to China, to bring back the UK nationals after the outbreak. And then we put them into quarantine in this country. And I don't know if you remember, but everyone that came back all went into hotels and stuff like that. Well, we looked after all of those people and nobody remembers anything about that. A month later, somebody said, this is not looking good. We need the military to come and help. And then we stood up 20,000 people from across defence, Royal Navy, Royal Air Force, British Army, commandos, in order to get on and help, to really do something. And the question was, what are we going to do? And they asked me, what are all these 20,000 people going to do? I said, I haven't got a clue. Honestly, got no idea what we were going to do. Did we have a COVID plan on the shelf that we were going to just pull down, kind of open up and go? No, no clue, no idea whatsoever. What we did have, which was really quite clever, was a flu pandemic plan. We knew that flu possibly was a thing. And that is one of the number one risks on the government's risk register. So what did we do? We took down the flu pandemic plan, opened that up and thought, right, COVID-19 is not a flu pandemic, but it's a good start. And probably it was a 70% start in where we were going. And one of the reasons why the military is so good is because people like you are really good at planning as well as execution. But what we're really good at is planning. And so, and this plan was probably a 60, 70% start on what we needed. So what did we do? We put planners out. We went to the strategic level, right at the top of government, Department for Health and Social Care, Justice, prisons, police, local communities. And we put our very, very best staff college trained senior commanders, men and women who were brigadiers, who were staff college trained, to help government departments think about the strategy of what was needed. But I think you'll agree that just having a decent strategy and a whole bunch of senior boffins at the top ain't going to solve the problem. So then we put all of our juniors in at the lowest level, down in the what we call LRS, the local resilience forums, down in local councils with NHS trusts. Fabian, you mentioned the JMCs, the Joint Military Commanders. That's the kind of brigadiers that run all the different regions. And guess how many planners we put out in government and in local authorities? We put 1,000 officers and warrant officers into those organizations. Because remember, the staff colleges had shut, people didn't have jobs. Most of the British Army, I know for a fact, and across defense, so I'm not sure about ships at sea, but everyone else kind of furloughed. And so we were really on sort of minimum money. So we put 1,000 of those people out there. And that is how we understood the situation. So step one of the estimate, understand, you know, what is going on and why. And that has been the success story, genuinely, of the whole of Operation Rescript. And then the way that I explain it after that is the rest is history. What did we do then? Nightingale Hospitals. We could talk about that and how that came about. Mobile testing units, genuine innovation by kind of young officers and young, well, reasonably young sort of staff sergeants and warrant officers and seniors who brought their brain power to the problem. We did PPE distribution, didn't we? Do you remember? We drove ambulances. Then we moved on to testing, Jono, Liverpool, you know, Ely, Kirklees, etc. And then we moved on to vaccination. So you can see how the program has sort of developed. And at its height, we had about 20,000 people on the ORBAT. We have about 13,000 now, so you can see how the numbers are kind of coming down. On every single day of the week, we probably had 6,000 people deployed actually on the ground. That number's now, you know, about 1,500. So, you know, things are coming down as the NHS and the government now is really getting on top of it. And largely, the vaccination rollout program, half the country now done, has taken place. So that has been brilliant. So that's where we are. And I think we're in a really good place. And I don't think COVID-19 is really going anywhere at the moment. Will it be ever eradicated? I think there's some good conversations we could have there. But for now, half the population done. And all being well, on the 17th of May, we might be having kind of outdoor barbecues with 30 people in the garden. Who knows? I genuinely hope so. And then, so, you know, hopefully in June, 21st of June, step three, which is kind of all restrictions lifted. Personally, I'm, you know, the latter one is a big ask, and we'll see how we go. So that's the COVID story. That's the Rescript piece for the benefit of all. So let's jump back into first impressions, which I think, you know, you never get a second chance to make a first impression, do you? And so I'd be really interested in kind of how it kind of worked out. And I think it would be good if we went through it chronologically in terms of how it deployed. So I think it's kind of Jono, then it's you, Ellie. Yeah. Then it's into outbreak management, Durga. And then Fabian, then it's into kind of vaccinations. And I think that's probably the way to do it. So Liverpool happened pretty quickly. 2,000 military people on the ground over the weekend. What did it feel like to you, Jono?
Yes, sir. So I was actually out on a recce for an exercise, which obviously didn't go ahead. But when we got the call, so we came back, sorted our stuff out. We were deployed very quickly without really, you know, much knowledge of what we were going into. We had sort of SOPs to read, but you don't really get an understanding for what the job actually is, what the task actually is until you get on the ground. So the first thing I did was I happened to run into an old Sandhurst buddy who put me in touch with someone who was running a testing site when I got down to Liverpool. So I went out and I saw a testing site in operation, and half an hour there made more sense of the SOPs, the standing operating procedures we've been given, than any amount of time I could have spent reading them. So actually seeing it on the ground working was really useful, but that was a public testing site. We then got told that we were going to be testing in schools. So that's quite a different picture to a public testing site. There's obviously a lot of considerations there in terms of data protection and actually, how do you get all these kids registered? How do you get the parental consent for these kids? It's a very different ball game. But I met a very good head teacher who worked at Calderstones School. Calderstones was the biggest school in Liverpool, about 1,700 kids at its peak. So a lot of kids to get through on the testing front. It was our first school, and the first day we went in, and we had an idea in our heads of how we wanted to run it based on the model that we'd seen in the public. It worked reasonably well. I think we got through about 400 kids on the first day, but I knew there was a lot of room for improvement. So I was constantly running around searching for ways of improving. And I think the the head teacher in terms of first impressions described me as insane to his students on a regular basis. I think that was a compliment. But yeah, I was just sort of buzzing around trying to look for ways we could make this better and trying not to anchor on the idea that we already had and thinking about different ways we could do things. So we ended up with a very different pupil-empowered registration model where we got them to register themselves a lot of the time by pushing out to classrooms, and then they would come to the site registered. And that made it much, much more efficient. That's why we were able to push the much higher numbers. But yeah, I think the overriding first impressions that I gave off were as someone who was very keen, but who thought we could achieve the world in a very quick space of time.
Oh, what a great story. Yeah, this is really important. Make friends before you need them. So this is about the liaison network. This is about not falling out with anybody. This is about getting, you know, in old speak, making sure you've got people's mobile telephone numbers and their email addresses. Come the day of the race, when it all goes badly wrong, you know who to turn to. And one of the lessons we have learned here is that all of those senior people we have in government departments, we're going to leave there now forever. You know, we have increased the establishment of the Standing Joint Headquarters. We're going to leave them there. So for the next crisis, we've already made our friends. That's a really great point you make there about, you know, you met a mate. That wasn't an accident. You cultivated that relationship earlier on. If you and that other platoon commander had fallen out and not been mates, trust me, it wouldn't have gone so well in Liverpool. I know that for a fact.
I was quite fortunate, sir, in that by sheer coincidence, I had to cancel a meeting with Wing Commander Friedman of 5 FP Wing. When I found out that I was being deployed down to Yorkshire. So when I said to him, I'm going down on rescript, I'm afraid I can't make next week's meeting. He was like, oh, I've just got back from, I think it's North Wales where they were, South Wales where 5 FP Wing were doing their rescript work. And he put me in contact with one of his team who was doing a similar role to what I was due to be doing. So I was quite fortunate in that, on a personal level, because being very junior to the RAF, never been deployed before, never really left Lossiemouth in a professional capacity, really. I was a bit nervous and didn't really know what to expect. And I was able to have that sort of reassurance that, yes, being deployed within 48 hours notice from Lossiemouth to North Yorkshire, this is what you're going to expect, and this is on arrival. So that was really good. So not completely blind, thankfully. Once I arrived, there was two junior officers that came down from Lossiemouth. So and then we had some more from, I think it was Coningsby, Waddington, and then the majority of the other workers on that Kirklees branch of rescript were based at Leeming, so they didn't have the two-day journey that I did down from Lossie. So once we arrived there and actually met each other and realised what it is what we were doing, nerves started to calm down a bit as it became a lot clearer. It was just that getting to know each other piece, really. So because for me, I'm a flight commander, but my flight is very small. I have less than 10 in my flight. So me being a leader of a group of 25 was something completely new to me. And I have excellent flight sergeants and sergeants up here with me, whereas it was just me and corporals and SACs and some people straight out of training as well, straight out of Halton. And so I sort of saw my role as, yes, I'm a team leader taking this group to a test centre to deliver testing to the general public, but also I need to be that reassurance piece and that welfare piece for this group of individuals who have very limited experience of wider RAF, and also some of them haven't really worked alongside civilians ever before, having joined up at the age of 17, 18 straight from school. So I saw it sort of a double hat, and I think I did it relatively well, because towards the end of the op, I got a lovely card saying thank you for making this so easy for us.
Great, what a lovely story, Ellie. Well done you. I think you've absolutely put your finger on why you're in this club. you know, why you wear this uniform, you know, your uniform, because it's about leadership. It's about delivering. It's about interpretation. This is great. I mean, it's almost as if we're kind of sharing scripts here, because my second mantras, I have three or four, I might be able to get some more in, who knows, but I've always said to people in the Standing Joint Headquarters, and actually in my Army day job, of course, as the Standing Joint Commander, this is a joint job in charge of all three services, but for the Army as well, it's just as applicable. But I always tell people, people deliver solutions. It doesn't matter how good your kit is, no matter how good your tech is, no matter how good your IT is, at the end of the day, some person has got to go out and do the business. So if you remember that people deliver solutions, Ellie, and that's your job, is to do that translation, because the top person can't understand what the bottom person's doing because it's so long since they've been there, me included, and the bottom person can't understand the intent of the top person because they it's all theoretical. So it's a really important job, this translation piece. So well done. That's a great story. Durga, let's go. So we were doing testing, and then in the country, life was getting really difficult for the NHS, and hospital beds, ICU were being overloaded, nurses working too hard, not getting enough sleep, leave being cancelled. My daughter is a physio on a COVID ward in the NHS in Bath. I was staying really close with her, finding out what it was about. And life was getting pretty tough for them. And we said, we have got combat medical technicians in defense who can come and help and do inoculations. We'll come to that in a minute, Fabian. But we've also got a whole bunch of really high quality men and women across defense who can just come and help. You know, we just come and help and relieve some of our doctors and maybe our nurses and our porters so that they can have some sleep even while we do the night shift, whatever it is you want us to do. So Durga, talk to us about your hospital when you got to Chesterfield.
Yes, sir. When we first got the notice, so personally for me, I wasn't in the bracket of opera script initially. We had already sent people down to the Midlands, and there were a few people who were going through the processes of going into hospitals. And because they required more people to be part of the force to bolster it, I was then picked up on it, and which rightfully I was quite happy to be tagging along with Opera Script as well. When I first got to Chesterfield Royal Hospital, it was more of a we were all my team of six, we were quite confused with regards to what can we do and how we can help. So when we first got there, we met with the trust executive for Chesterfield Royal Hospital, and she was explaining to us with regards to what we can help with. So the jobs entailed was more towards catering, portering, and also towards domestics, which was helping out and sterilizing the wards, so basically cleaning everything, and also with regards to housekeeping. So initially we were given a brief about what we might do, and then for the first weekend we worked out with catering and helped out with domestics, so cleaning the wards. From Monday onwards, it was more of we then were divided into different wards. So we then got to see and deal with COVID patients and also work alongside doctors and nurses. So it was quite when I first got into the ward, I was quite overwhelmed because everyone was running around everywhere, as in they were quite busy. So the pace that they were working in, and I don't know how the nurses and doctors do it. They they just move about. So they're always on their feet. So it's they just keep a very cheerful mood as well. With regards to first impressions with being actually working in the ward, it was quite manic. We were quite because we had to just we had to learn alongside with the housekeeper that was already working in the ward. We had to learn his or her daily job, and had to help in whatever way we can with regards to the stocks and supplies that were needed. We were doing much of running around and fetching or more of ordering a patient's meal. And also when the patients, when they initially first realized that we were part of the military, because we had this ID tag with it saying military COVID worker, and they were quite pleased to see us. They were quite happy. So even though they were in a very hurtful state, so they were suffering with COVID and feeling very bad, when they first saw our presence there, they were quite happy, and they would smile, and they would share stories about how their family was, as in the families, a member of their families serving the army as well. And when they even found out that I was part of the Gurkhas, for some that did know, they were quite happy and said that their grandfathers or their fathers served with the Gurkhas and stuff like that. And also when they found out that I was from the country where Mount Everest is, and they were like, have you been to Mount Everest and stuff like that? So it was quite interesting. And overall, in working with the doctors and nurses, they were really great people, because I really felt like I bonded well with them. So I was at home with them, and yeah, so I was glad to be part of the team. So.
Great. Well, what a fantastic story. I got this idea, you know, the military and the public eye, is this has been a great opportunity. And one of the rules that I specified back in the day, I said, you know, if you want the military to come, whether it's in schools or wherever, we're wearing uniform. You know, we're not pretending we're something else. We're not coming in tracksuits or kind of civvies. We're coming in uniform. We're going to be dressed, you know, in our business attire, what we normally work in. And that's one of the stipulations. Because I wanted the country to know that the military and the armed forces was kind of here to help. And we don't get that opportunity very often. And actually, it just does remind me, on day one, I can't remember what hospital it was. It wasn't yours, but there was a flight sergeant somewhere. And I said to him, crikey, what was it like on your first day? And he said to me, sir, looked at my Fitbit, 25,000 steps before lunch. What do you think my day's been like? Which I thought was an absolutely brilliant answer. And kind of matches what you've been talking about, Durga, kind of running around. Okay, I thought of one of my other mantras I've been talking about, which you remind me about, Durga, which is, you know, that being uncertain when you first go and do something new. And you mustn't be worried about needing all the answers, because one thing the military is really good at, we don't have a crystal ball. One thing we are really good at is kind of managing in adversity, managing without knowing all the information. And so you will never have all the answers. And so what I say is, we won't give you all the answers, but we will train you to ask a better question. So I think that's the crucial thing. The answers you get will only be based on the questions that you ask. So really think about the question that you ask. And I think the next thing people want to know, so have a little think about this. Next question is probably something about challenges. I'll start it off, but you know, the one big challenge that you had that you faced when you first arrived, it's not really a first impression, but what was that big challenge that you had, you know, either personally or collectively in your team? And how did you manage to solve it? You know, did you overcome it, or was it still there when you left? What did you do to have a think about that challenge? Right, Fabian, let's come to you.
Roger, sir. So from that perspective, I've been working up in JMC Scotland, so where we came in to assist with the national planning support team and the local planning support teams within health boards to deliver both a planned and timeline execution of delivery of vaccinations throughout the country. Doing that in itself took a lot of effort from JMC Scotland, first of all, to get an understanding from St Andrew's House, and understanding where health board demand was highest, who needed the help first and foremost, and where those priorities lay, what manning we had available, and how we could best deliver the effect that we wanted to achieve. Scotland came to the party a little later than some of the rest of the country, in the sense that a lot of our CMTs, our combat medical technicians, had already become a very niche pinch point specialty, where they were trying to get us all out the door as much as we could with nothing being wasted. And essentially, when we came up to Scotland, I got the opportunity to amalgamate 16 different units worth of combat medical technicians into 8 different teams to have 8 team leaders and 88 service personnel into these teams. 10 vaccinators each with a general duties medical officer, so a non-specialized practitioner, doctor, to manage that team and give them the oversight they needed while delivering vaccinations. Because as much as vaccinations are very straightforward, and once you've gotten good at them, you do it consistently and quite rapidly with lovely personal bedside manner, it's also important to understand what reactions people can have, how nervous people might seem, making sure that you're both encouraging as well as reassuring, because it can be a point of difference for some people when you're getting a vaccination from somebody in uniform and you're in a massive hall, nice and spaced out, where everything's very methodical and step-by-step process. Some people can find that a whole new experience to get used to. But from our time here, it's been quite impressive. So far, bringing Scotland in line with the rest of the country as well, with the percentage of those that have had their first and second doses, it's been an eye-opener as to the scale to which that takes planning and time, because the different health boards each had their own military planners. Those military planners fed into the National Planning Support Team. Those planners also had their points of contact within the NHS and St Andrew's House, where they had an understanding of what they wanted to achieve and how, and then it was about translating that into a military output and how we could then, what we needed to achieve, the outputs they requested, how long they'd need them for, and then making sure that it's a consistent output, that we can maintain that and not just bomb burst our medics as well as the NHS staff into being absolutely ragged before the first 3 weeks are done. We've had a lot of positive feedback from the general public, from a board. I sent out a storyboard to my unit, which is essentially a nice little rundown of one of our sites in Dunfermline at Templehall Community Centre, where they had a full board filled with positive comments on the NHS and military staff, and how efficient they were, how quick and painless everything seemed, and how methodical it all went through. Especially because we were delivering to the older cohorts first, it was very much good to hear, because getting feedback, everyone can seem quite nervy at times when you get that opportunity to meet someone in uniform and speak to them face to face. You've got a 10-minute appointment, you've got the time to get to know them. It puts a face to the army and a face to the vaccination forces out there. So it's been a very good opportunity, and it's been great hearing about it from the team leads as well. I regularly update them to then let JMC Scotland know all about how it's going and what the outputs and effects are.
What a great story. I think, crikey, Fab, you've absolutely got stuck right there into all those challenges and questions that I was hoping to ask later. You seem to have answered everything there, which has given us a brilliant insight. So thank you very much indeed for that. That's superb. How about just talking, if you don't mind, just talking a little bit about, challenges personally. I know everyone else listening will be really interested in kind of how you felt about it. So, Jono, just, you're kind of like first into the breach. So, personally, are you happy to talk about your kind of feelings? For me, I can tell you that I felt the loneliness of command. The Secretary of State for Defence and ministers ringing me up to tell me what was going on, what I was going to do about X. I had the most amazing team supporting me, and I know you all did as well. But at the end of the day, in the middle of the night on a Sunday, being phoned up by ministers and the Secretary of State, when I was at home with my family, being asked, we need to do something, what are you going to do? And no time to really ask and contemplate. So for me personally, I felt it was quite a lonely place, despite the fact that I had brilliant people supporting me. And I think that's something about the military, particularly the officers, you will find later on. So it's worth being comfortable with that. And it took me a long time to do so. What about you, Jono? How did you feel?
So this sort of thing runs through my blood a bit, sir, because my mum was a GP for 40 years, her dad was a GP. And so actually going into a healthcare environment where we're helping people was pretty much why I signed up. The humanitarian aid piece, but also doing it in the UK was equally, rewarding. So, for me, I signed up because I believe the army is trying out and out to help people wherever we go. That is our eventual aim. So yeah, I was really, really pleased to be doing it. And both my brother and sister are now involved in healthcare. I think it was quite a natural thing for me to try and tie in a bit on the challenges front as well. You know, in the schools, we were just trying to minimise disruption as much as possible. And that's, you know, my experience is that schools want you in and out as quick as you can. Yeah. And I was really fortunate to have a really highly motivated team of 22 guys. And in our day jobs, I think we see, you know, systems that could be changed, but it's a big organisation. It's very difficult to do that. Whereas, you know, I had 22 brains on the ground who were all seeing little changes that we could just enact. And so that was really rewarding. And I think my sergeant still tells the story of me waking him up at 1 o'clock in the morning because I'd come up with a new layout that would save the people running around collecting tests a huge amount of time in terms of the amount of actual distance they had to cover. So he tells that story in a funny way. But, you know, that's the kind of, I was having not a lot of sleep, but because I was so highly motivated in terms of, right, how can we make this better? Because we were all able to make an impact.
You put your finger on what I call noble professions. So in on top of hours, as in being in the armed forces, you know, teaching and nursing, to me, you know, not paid a lot and do the most amazing job, you know, for our country, which is brilliant. How about you, Durga? How did you feel? Because you were in a sort of, you were right kind of the front line of patients.
Yes, sir. So firstly was the first challenge that I faced was trying to get to know what stuff was what. To begin with, what was a catheter? What was all this medical equipment that they use? So it was kind of the challenge that we had to overcome firstly. And then, but sooner or later, we managed to pretty much get on top of it within the first half of the week. And then we were quite okay. But the other challenge that I faced was more of in terms of dealing with losses, which was because we would have one-to-one contact with patients, and as some of them are quite cognitive, so we were able to have share conversations. And so there were a few patients that that I've shared conversations with that have their health rapidly deteriorate over a short span of time. And it was quite disheartening to see that and know that some of the patients that you were talking to with one day would not be there on their bed spaces the next day when you come in for work. And that was quite a very emotionally challenging aspect for me. The way we got around dealing with, as in the way how the NHS, as in the doctors and nurses, they all get around is we tend to talk about it just so that we can get it off our shoulders. So that's kind of like what we used to remedy for our own emotional challenge as well. So we and my four and the six people in my team, we were constantly talking about it, trying to get into terms with it. And yes, sir. So it was quite difficult.
I mean, you put your finger now right on the heart of kind of what we do in the military, you know, because this is a personal game we're in. You know, this is what we do. Combat is visceral. It's frightening. It's bloody. And we're finding that in UK ops, you know, we're coming across all sorts of new emotional challenges that perhaps we weren't really expecting. You know, first and foremost, talk to your peer group, talk to your friends, talk to your family. And, you know, don't bottle this up. That's the way to kind of deal with it. So, terrific. Well, well done, Dirk. Thank you very much. And then finally, Ellie, before I wrap up, what about friends and family?
So I think for me to describe the challenges that my friends and family had, I'd need to put in a little bit of backstory. So I've done the standard junior officer upon joining the military thing, and I got a dog. So one of my first initial thoughts about, oh, hold on, what about me, when I found out that I was going down to rescript was, how do I get my dog down to my parents in the space of 2 days when I live in the north of Scotland and they're in Cambridgeshire? But my parents met me halfway, did a dodgy handover and a lay-by of giving them. So it's this support element that my parents were giving me was them giving me my dog updates. And but I think what they struggled with and the challenges that they faced knowing that I was out on rescript was how quiet I ended up being. That I was doing long days in the test center. I was doing those 25,000 steps before lunchtime, unable to get my phone out because I was behind behind the screen of where the testing was happening. So phones had to stay away. And when I got back to the hotel in the evenings, it was get food, go to sleep, ready for the next day. Then on my one down day, I just wanted to crash out and go to sleep and recover for the next group of shifts. So I think they actually really, really struggled with that unknown of what was going on with me. But one of the nicest things was actually my one of my closest friends, who's also in the military, she sent me a news article of the work that we were doing. So she'd found in the local news, I think it was her mum had found it in their local newspaper and sent a copy and go, oh, is that what Ellie's doing? And that was really nice. So receiving that from a friend and knowing that the work that we were doing had gone out into the local news and was really positive was really nice. But I think the friends and families of the guys that I was working with, we were away over Christmas and New Year. So that welfare piece came into play massively. It's like, who needs to go? I had to make that decision. Like, who really needs to go home? Who really needs to have their off day? So it falls over Christmas or it falls over New Year. And that was one of the most, probably the most difficult decisions I've made whilst being in the military, trying to open that conversation with the team and be like, right, some of us are going to have to stay here. Yeah. over Christmas, over New Year, and aren't going to be able to see our families. I need your help in making that decision because it's not one I feel like is right for me to make on my own. So I opened that discussion up to the team, and we worked through it. And I think because I opened it up, it was well received, rather than me just making that call saying that, right, you're staying here, you're able to go.
Well done. You put your finger on a whole bunch of really good lessons there. You know, coming back from operations, as I have a couple of times, you know, trying to slip back into my families, you know, they haven't had a clue really what I've been doing while I've been away. But also you haven't really understood what they've been doing while you've been away. And you are going to have to get back in contact with your friends and family and your partners, etc. So that's a really good, valuable lesson. And I think the second valuable lesson there is about collaborative working. You know, the days of kind of officers shouting at junior ranks, you know, to get things long gone. You know, that's not how we do our business in the military. And lots of my civilian mates think that's what I do all day. You know, make big decisions by myself and shout at soldiers. Nothing could be further from the truth, trust me. So you've learned a really valuable lesson there as a junior officer. So well done. That's really good. And Fabian, it's sort of in a nutshell, because it's the last kind of moment, I'll leave you the last word in terms of memorable moments in a nutshell?
Definitely, sir. So probably my memorable moment is my time spent catching up with all of my squadron that's been deployed all over the country. There's a lot of different aspects that a lot of them have touched on, some of them being COVID-facing ICU wards, vaccinations, general duties, ambulance services, hearing the stories from the paramedics. The words on the ground is what I've been trying to get my best understanding of, to see how troops have been handling things from an emotional perspective, being away from their families, working on COVID-facing wards. As Lance Corporal Grung mentioned, it is challenging and it is taxing on them. And it is catching up with them has probably been one of my happier moments, hearing from them how they've gotten on, their experiences, what they've gained and learned. It has been very insightful to see a lot of the younger ones, especially, that have come straight out of phase two and then deployed with some of our clinicians to go straight on to helping on COVID wards. It has been a great eye-opener to see the opportunity for them to shine. And it's been a real privilege to hear about their stories and their enthusiasm.
That's a great summary. And I love the listening thing. You know, don't just listen. You've really got to hear what people are saying. Yeah, two ears, one mouth, though. Make sure you use them in those proportions, yeah? I can't tell you what a fantastic, I don't know how long that's been, but an hour, apparently. You know, I was told, you know, anytime, you know, between 30 and 40 minutes is normally about normal, but it just goes to show, you know, what really wonderful people you are, what you have been doing in society in support of our nation, which is what, you know, the armed forces is all about. And I'll just finish by saying, I asked the chief operating officer of the National Health Service, what is it about the military that you love so much, you know, because they can't do without it. They don't want to do without us. They love our liaison. What is it? And I think the answers are, they surprised me. Some did. So four things. One is resilience. You've all got that. And you've all been talking about that, getting woken up in the middle of the night, working long hours. Second one is discipline. We sort of take that for granted. You know, And she said to me, there's a meeting at 7:30 in the morning and all of you are here 5 minutes before. That's discipline, you know, shaving in the morning, being washed and cleaned, etc. You know, being smartly turned out, having your hair put up. All those sort of things are really, really important. Thinking outside the box. There you go. Going back to the kind of asking better questions. We just think differently because we have slightly different DNA than perhaps our civilian partners. And I think the one that really surprised me, well, surprised me, but pleased me, was a sense of humor. And being able to have a sense of humor in adversity will see all four of you straight, both on operations and in peacetime and in your normal day duties in barracks. So resilience, discipline, thinking outside the box, most importantly, a sense of humor, never lose that and you won't go far wrong. Guys, you've been absolutely brilliant. I know that the people that are listening and will pick this up kind of later will thoroughly enjoy listening to what you've had to say. I think you're all inspiration. I wish you the very best of luck in your careers as they go forward. And do keep in touch. Really great to see you. Take care.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks for listening to Fancy a Brew. Check out other episodes at bfbs.com/podcasts.